Okay, it's 8 o'clock on the East Coast, so let's get started. You remember that we ended on page 215 about this comment from Moses where she says, now the violent power of this hand surges the one last time. His life from Egypt onward has become a dark fruition. Okay, and so let's continue now with the potential space section on page 215 where she's talking about more description about what's happening to Moses, obviously the central character in the book of Numbers. And so we want to pay really close attention to how all of this affects him. Okay, so we'll start with the first paragraph on 215 under the topic, by the hand of Moses. Just remember to mute your microphones if you're not asking a question so we don't get the background noise, and here we go. But the history of Moses' hand is complex and layered, she says. Shaped by an instrument of divine anger, Moses' hand gathers memories of past selves, conserving the experience of a particular moment of being. Each memory is itself saturated by previous moments. It's interesting that she's talking like this, because what she's really talking about is the symbolic representation of the collective unconscious. We can think about the psychological idea of the collective unconscious in Jung, right? She says, revelations from the past cluster around these memories, which flash back like lightning to the beginning. We remember Walter Benjamin on Proust. For an experienced event is finite. A remembered event is infinite, because it is only a key to everything that happened before it and after it. And the reason I mark that is because you need to understand what Benjamin is saying here in order to interpret what Heschel says when he says to believe is to remember. But he's not talking about believing an individual event occurred, like the Exodus from Egypt. What he's talking about is participating in an event that occurred in the past that has ongoing relevance to the present and creates the tradition necessary for the whole assembly to be connected to what happened in Egypt, what happened in Sinai, what happened in the desert, what happened in the entrance to the promised land, right? So this is just another way of saying what Heschel says, to believe is to remember. All right, let's skip over to page 217. At the end of that section, just the second paragraph for the end, she says, where she writes, take utmost care for that you do not so that you do not forget the things that you saw with your own eyes, so that you do not they do not fade from your mind as long as you live. Deuteronomy 4:9. But obviously, no one in the crowd saw it with their own eyes. It's an interesting metaphor that Moses employs as he's speaking to the generation that will pass over into the Jordan, referring to them as though they were witnesses. But it's the same process that we just talked about with Heschel, that the events continue, right? It's, remember at Sinai when the people say, we'll wait for God to tell you what it is, and God and the instruction is that these are for the people here and for the generations to follow. So the idea of continuity is built right into the covenant, and these symbolic events represent the fact that we actually stood there at Sinai when all this occurred. We were symbolically represented in the rebellion. We were symbolically represented in the wilderness. We were symbolically represented in the crossing of the Jordan. All those things were as though they happened to us and we were there. So she says, after this passage on from Deuteronomy 4:9, referring to the revelation at Mount Sinai, Moses here addresses the new generation who in fact did not see that revelation. All those whose eyes had literally seen have vanished into the sands. How can this new generation be urged to remember things seen by others? Perhaps it is precisely in the absence of that visual experience that a deepened inner vision, clusters of memory that reach through the generations, can be evoked, right? So what she's saying is there's a kind of collective unconscious in the Hebraic idea of history that passes from one generation to the next, right? So So Hebrew history isn't written as event chronology. We've talked about that many, many times. But now Zornberg is pointing out that event chronology is insufficient to talk about the notion of Hebrew history because it doesn't acknowledge the participation of the current generation in everything that happened in the past generations. It's not event chronology. It's tribal identity. It's the affiliation of me with those people who spent their lives in the wilderness and who's witnessed those things. It's my connection with them that's part of this Hebrew account of the events. It's not simply, you know, a historical record. If we read it as a historical record, we will have missed the point. And I think, as you've seen, we work our way through Zornberg. She's constantly pushing us to examine the events from a psychological point of view so that we are involved in those events. Okay? Now, let's go over to 220. Letters fly off. She's talking about the tension inherent in such moments of climax, I suggest, when Moses undoes God's writing in the stone tablets. Moses' hands open and let the tablets fly. This is done before the eyes of all Israel. It responds to and it challenges their human desire to confirm the evidence of their senses. And then she says, she talks about a midrash. Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner reads in this second way, elaborating on the virtues of forgetting. The life of the oral Torah begins here. When conscious memory ends, the mind begins to reconstruct. Because of forgetting, a world of interpretation and vital argument springs up. Okay, did you get that? Because of forgetting, right? It's not just remembering. It's also the process of forgetting, because in the process of forgetting, new interpretation is created, right? The whole point is, if I only remember the exact order of events and all the circumstances that actually happened, I diminish my ability to be creative in my interpretation of the events, because it only happened in one way. This is Zornberg's idea of certainty, right? As long as language is able to interpret the event, certainty is not only not possible, it's not desirable, because it curtails the ability to be creative. So what she's saying here is, when Moses throws down the tablets and destroys them, that allows the circumstances of God's delivery to be completely reinterpreted, because they no longer have the evidence. Now they have to remember. And those things that they've forgotten have to be reinstated, have to be recreated through the action of interpretation. So she says, what the people have once seen is immediately forgotten on the death of Moses. 300 laws vanish from the national memory until the judge, Othniel ben Kanaz, retrieves them through his peel pool, his brilliantly creative interpretation. Sometimes the unmaking of Torah is its fulfillment. Then she says this, in remembering, one holds on to what one knows. In forgetting, one smashes the icons of the past, makes it possible to know differently, to access by a different route what was once simply present. Okay? So think about that. Think about how important, first, you think about how important memorization is, right? Because we need to know what God said, but we also need the process of forgetting so that we can reinterpret the message in a different way, so that we can creatively respond to it in a way that we never could if we had everything listed exactly as it happened. Okay? Now, let's skip over to 222, where she's talking about the rock. She says, I'm trying to get the context here. To see God's, the bottom of 2 and 21, seeing God's message would have generated faith, trust, intimate connection, but he fails to engage their depth perception for the moment. To see God's words is to bring one's personal presence, conscious and unconscious, to the scene. To be affected, to the roots of one's being by something staged before one's eyes. But for this to happen, one must have eyes that can see. Such an intensity of vision is evoked in the Midrash. Each person saw himself standing in the presence of the rock. This is the scene of presences. The people are gathered, El Pnei HaSelah, face to face with a rock. Each person sees his or her own presence in the presence of the rock. Looking at the thing, one endows it with a face. A space is created between two faces, right? So what she's really saying is what we've been saying here in this idea of symbolic involvement in the original event, right? That is, the Midrash suggests that every person, just as Sinai, every person heard God speak, now every person is face to face with the rock and has an individual corporate experience. It's a corporate experience, but it's individual moderated. It's individually moderated in such a way that it has meaning for me, different than the meaning for you, right? And of course, that's also part of this whole process of the children of Israel coming out of Egypt and learning what it means for God to be involved with each individual in the corporate identity, in the corporate assembly, right? So she says at the bottom of 223, she's talking about Impressionist paintings. Impressionist painting no longer invites one into an alcove of changeless time and space. What it shows is painted in such a way that you are compelled to recognize that it is no longer there. The viewer's memories are often pleasurable, yet they are also anguished because each viewer remains alone. Memory is the unacknowledged access of all of Monet's work. His famous love of sea, of rivers, of water, was perhaps a symbolic way of speaking of tide sources and reoccurrence. And well, of course, what she's doing is saying that every single one of us who stands in front of a Monet has a different experience of what that means. How should it be? How could it not be the same when we come to a text that deliberately has no vowels, requires the reader to be engaged in the interpretation just to read it, and furthermore, has levels of meaning that penetrate all the way down to the mystical, right? No individual person can read the Torah in the same way that another individual person can. Because even if you read the Torah, even if you read the Torah together and you read exactly the same words, the impact of the words at the four levels of interpretation and the interpretation of the meaning of those words will be different for you than for the person sitting right next to you. Okay? Now, that is one of the reasons why translation is so pitiful, because it restricts my ability to have an imaginative and creative experience with a language that I have to provide the vowels for. You know, one of the things I love about spending time with the rabbi here every week is that we go through not just a Torah study, but we're also doing prayers from the Siddur and stuff like that. And what we, of course, we run across these little places in the Torah and in the Siddur that are bracketed. And what I mean is they are written one way and read another way. An example I can give you is when Rahab is speaking with the spies. We're working in Joshua now. And according to the tradition, you read it, my father's house and my brothers and sisters. But it doesn't spell that way. It's spelled my brothers and sister. But it's read plural. In spite of the fact that it's clearly a singular word, it's read as a plural. Why? Because the interpretive history is to read it as brothers and sisters, regardless of how it's written. So what does that mean? It means that the vowels that were provided by the Masoretes made the consonants into a singular read as a plural. But if I change the vowels, I'll get a different meaning out of it. And I, as the interpreter of the text, am almost free to do that because the vowels are a part of the tradition, right? They weren't written into the text. The text was written in the consonants. So now I have to go and decide how I'm going to read the text and what it means to me as a result of that. And that's only one little tiny example of this pattern that happens where it's written one way and read another way, or where it's or similar, right? Things that are left out that are read into the text, or things that are in the text that are left out when you're reading the text. All that kind of stuff happens because of the tradition. But as Zornberg points out, it means that I have to be involved. I can't just take the translation and read it and pretend that that's what it says, because it doesn't. It says what it means to me when I read the text according to the way that I see what's happening in the text. Right? Now, I can read that according to the traditional way and be in alignment with people who've read it that way for a long time, or I can raise a question like many of the rabbis do and say, wait a minute, what if we read the text like this? Right? That creativity can't come about in translation, because the English or the French or the Spanish or whatever, the Italian, fixes the text. See, the Hebrew text is essentially ambiguous. That's what's so wonderful about it, because it lets God weave himself into the words in a way that can't happen in the translation. Okay, so she says on 225, she's talking about Kafka and the myth of the parable of Prometheus. And she says in the middle of that paragraph, or the middle of the word, what remains after this? What's left behind? The inexplicable mass of rock, the legend, tried to explain the inexplicable. As it came out of the substratum of truth, it had in turn to end in the inexplicable. Here's the citation. The substratum of truth underlies all the weariness of time. This is the timeless quality of the inexplicable that will, in Robert Alter's words, eternally compel urgent questions, right? And you know Alter because of the great translation that he did of the Tanakh. But the point that she's making is that underneath all of this activity of trying to understand, of interpreting, of reading, of translating, underneath it all is a substratum of truth that is eternal, but is not accessible directly as we would, you know, suppose it to be if we were translating it, because as Alter points out, it eternally compels you to urgent questions, right? Like, why do we read it like this? What does this mean? Why does it say that? I mean, I've been writing a bunch of today's word stuff about verses in Joshua that force you to ask those questions because the words are wrong, right? Because the words don't fit the grammar properly, because the words have extra consonants in them, because the words don't make any sense in the way that they're written in the text. They force you to ask questions that are deeper than the text, right? I just this morning, I was working on a passage in John where Yeshua meets the cripple at the pool of Siloam, right? And he asks him, in translation, the most foolish and obvious question anybody could ever ask. The guy's been laying there for 38 years, and Yeshua comes up and asks him, do you want to be made well? I mean, it's the question is so obvious that no one would ever ask it, right? And of course, in translation, it looks like that's the question that he asks. In fact, the NASB translates it, do you want to get well? Which is completely ridiculous. No one would ask that question of a man who's been laying there for 38 years trying to get to the water on time. So obviously there's something else happening. And what's happening, of course, is not in the translation, but buried into the other meanings of the Greek terms translated from the Hebrew that Yeshua spoke to talk about what's actually happening in the man's inner constitution, not his physical legs. That's simply a matter of, you know, stand up and walk. The question really is asking is, who are you? What constitutes who you are? Is that what you want to be made whole or to be generated sound, as the Greek actually says? Okay? So there's something else going on underneath these obvious questions that forces us to look deeper. And I think that's what Zornberg's got her finger on here, that something else is happening. And if we only read the level of the text as an informative piece about history, we'll miss everything about the important point. Okay? So let's go over to the next page on 226, where she says, she quotes from Paul Valéry, "To see is to forget the name of the things one sees," writes the poet Paul Valéry. "Seeing in this way dissolves the rock and the rod into a stream of impressions. The prophet Ezekiel speaks of change, flux, forgetting as the marks of redemption." And she quotes from Ezekiel 36:26, "And I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit into you. And I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh." Okay? And we know that passage because it's about the new covenant. But it's actually about the millennial age. But the interesting thing about it, in Zornberg's perspective, what that means is a new sense of creativity, because I'm no longer rigidly bound to a heart of stone that codifies exactly how I must think. She says, "In this vision, the stony heart is an alien presence in human flesh. God's promise of a redeemed reality is to reconstitute the human being as all flesh, all impressionable, receptive to impressions, responsive to the light energy coming from behind the visible," right? So it's not just a matter of, I'm going to rewrite the covenant commandments on your heart so that they're living word. What she's really suggesting is that God is going to recreate the human constitution so that it becomes a receptive clay to the movement of the spirit to be reinterpreted and rewritten again and again and again, to be thought through a new way each time. Okay, so let's go to let's go over to 229 in this section called Generating Holiness. She says, the long paragraph, "The Talmud offers guidance on how holiness may be generated." And it's a citation from Leviticus. "And I shall be sanctified in the midst of the Israelites." How is God sanctified in the midst of his people? By speaking words of holiness in public. So God turns immediately to Moses and Aaron, "Because you have not believed in me so as to sanctify me before the eyes of the Israelites, they have not spoken words of holiness such as to create faith in the power of those words within them. Instead, Moses has wielded words as blunt instruments. The people remain unprepared for the gentler, more organic movements of self-awareness." And I might say, for the gentler, more organic benevolence that God wants to show them. "The miracle that is not God's will drives a wedge between them and the future," right? Moses, it isn't just the rod that Moses uses to strike the rock. He strikes the people with his words. He puts as much violent energy in the words as he does in his arm descending upon the rock. And in doing so, he misrepresents the character of God's benevolence, and that is a punishable offense. So she says further down that page, the last paragraph on the page, "What then is the emunah, the faith that has sadly not happened here? Marhal offers us a key. The experience of emunah is the experience of being drawn after God, willingly, by his word alone. This experience generates joy, and joy in turn demonstrates the existence of emunah. Moses is to speak to the rock so that it will transcend its stony nature and be moved in attraction after God. To be attracted to an object is, paradoxically, to be at one's most free, at one's most autonomous." Why? Because you willingly decide to follow it, right? So when Moses uses blunt in the blunt instrument of the rod and the words to pummel the people. He prevents them from willingly deciding to follow the benevolence of God that should have been shown in the rock. Okay, so let's go over to 230. She says in that last paragraph on that section, even rocks can discover their own power of response. And then she quotes from Yitzhak Huttner again. The miracle of the rock that produces water includes the miracle of its effect on the human soul. In other words, the most miraculous thing is the movement of the soul in being drawn after God. Other images might have served to express the gift of water, heavy rains, or deep underground springs, but the imagery of water from a rock has an intimate resonance for those before whose eyes it is enacted. It speaks to the possibility of a new, more responsive nature opening within them. As in a dream or a reverie, the stony heart gives way to the heart of flesh. A child grows to discover the power of language of conveyance. Okay? So you can see why the rock story is so crucial to our understanding, not only of who Moses is, but of why it is such an important part of God's step before he brings the people into the promised land, right? Because it represents the transition of an inner awareness that all of creation is now becoming malleable, right? The rock itself brings forth water. It couldn't have a better image of what was at once impenetrable, all of a sudden providing life, right? So that inexplicable rock, as Zornberg points out, is really, really important to understanding the transition that God's trying to bring to these people. And she concludes this on 232. She talks about the philosopher Kenneth Burke. The philosopher Kenneth Burke writes eloquently of the world of nature that gleams secretly with a most fantastic shimmer of words and social relationships. The Midrashic literature deals with this impressionist world of nature and the supernatural. The Torah reveals and conceals. Implicitly, its enigmatic stories entitle the reader to read and to speak. Okay? And I want to pay attention to her comment that the Torah reveals and conceals. It's exactly what Heschel says, right? That the way that God works in the world is not to, you know, emblazon his name across the sky in the flashes of lightning, but to conceal himself so that, as Yeshua says, you have to seek him to find him. It doesn't mean that he's not there. It means that he deliberately conceals himself because it's up to the reader to interpret the event so that I find God within it, right? Now, I was just recently working on some stuff about when bad things happen to good people, right? And there's a sense in which the concealment of God occurs even there, right? It's no different than the rabbi saying, basically, even in our sins, we worship God, right? Because what we really want to do is realize that in the universe that we're part of, this universe that Zornberg is talking about, bad things happen. And sometimes not for rational reasons, right? They happen because the world is created in such a way that human beings are a necessary part of fulfilling God's purposes. And because there's more than one free will agent involved in fulfilling the purposes, random events can occur, right? Randomness is the price of free will. So if I want human creativity, I can't have human creativity if everything is already prescripted ahead of time. There has to be the ability for things to not work out in order for me to have to have worthiness as a human agent in the purposes of God. What does that mean? That means that the impressions that I have and the response that I have to those impressions will change the way that the order of the world occurs, so that it will work its way into a new understanding from God's perspective and ours about how the world is going to manifest God's glory, right? And I need that kind of undeterminedness in order for me to have value in the process, which means, of course, that when bad things happen, like Moses striking the rock, it changes events. It doesn't mean that God's not in control, but it alters the path in which the world proceeds. And that has to be the possibility in order for me to have an actual part in the plan of God's purposes, right? So Zornberg is trying to get at that when she talks about the concealing and revealing. Look, it basically comes down to this. If God showed you everything all at once, not only would you be incapable of making decision because the weight of it all would be too much for a human being, but it would freeze your ability to feel a worthwhileness, because you would recognize, you might recognize how much or how little of the plan depends on you. And the result of that is you evaluate what God has already determined will be the process that he wants to occur given the circumstances that are now in place, right? We don't get that choice. We get the choice of determining what to do to maintain the character of God in the circumstances that we have as we know them. And that will change. And it's okay that it changes, because it means that we have value in this process. We, as Heschel would say, God searches for man in order to complete the process of creation, right? We have the same task to finish the creative process. It wasn't done at the end of Genesis chapter 1. It just was started. And now we have to finish it out. And to do that, we have to look for the concealed God hidden in the events that we recognize with our own senses, but need to examine in a deeper way. Okay, let's go to chapter 9. And we'll start on page 237. She's talking about Balaam's answer to the new delegation. And she says, in spite of, at the bottom of 236, she says, we notice indeed that Balak's commission unconsciously echoes parodies God's original blessing to Abraham. And then she says at the top of 237, in another Talmudic comment, Rava says, this teaches that in the way a person wants to go, he is allowed to go. Clearly, Balaam's desire is a factor in softening God's position. One is led, says Rava, in the direction of one's desire. Why is that important? I marked it down because it reminds me of the rabbi's saying, if a man determines to obey God, God will assist him. But if he determines not to obey God, God will allow it, right? So either way, God is involved in the decision, right? Actually, God is involved in preparing the way, as Rava says, in preparing the way of my desire, even if that desire is in opposition to him, okay? She says on the same page, the question of obedience is ironically focused at this juncture. Balak has proclaimed that he is ready to do whatever Balaam requires. God, on the contrary, declares that Balaam will do whatever he requires. Balak defines his relation to Balaam as one of an obedient servant to a superior, but God sets the terms in which Balaam is to be his obedient servant. Balak gives Balaam the power of saying, while God reserves that power for himself. And again, Zornberg concentrates one more time on this theme that language creates. Language actually creates the worlds that we're involved in. It gives us new insight into James' exhortations about the use of the tongue. Because what Zornberg is saying is, how you speak creates the world that you're in, right? It manifests a world around you. And if you change your language, change your speaking, change your vocabulary, you change the word or the world that you participate in. So she goes over on 239. She's talking about the Balaam's character traits. And she says, apparently docile, obedient to God's commands, even humble, Balaam, in Midrashic thought, becomes a case study of unconscious motivation. Arrogance, greed, envy, like other deadly sins, do not always proclaim themselves. Rather, they suffuse the physical being of the one who lives them. In other words, they manifest themselves in a physical way that doesn't require an actual moral choice. Then she says, a little further down, Freud, too, has a clinical observation on the same phenomenon. He that has eyes to see and ears to hear may convince himself that no mortal can keep a secret. If his lips are silent, he chatters with his fingertips. Betrayal oozes out of him at every pore. We only have to think of the descriptions of characters in the Bible whose words said one thing, but whose bodily behavior said something else, right? So let's go a little bit further down on the same page, 239. She says, the rabbis learn about Balaam. They apply an almost psychoanalytic awareness to the indirections of passions. Take, for instance, the heart of the narrative, the drama of curses turned into blessings. Three times this turning happens. When Moses later revisits the narrative, he makes turning the essential dramatic move. No Ammonite or Moabite may ever enter the community of God because he, Balak, hired Balaam to curse you. And God, your God, turned the curse into a blessing. For God, your God, loves you, right? Now, I put in my margin, Ruth defeats Balaam. She doesn't intend to, but the fact of the matter is, her demonstration of chesed is so powerful that it undoes this curse, right? It changes the direction of Israel because of her use of the words of chesed and her behavior that follows those words. Okay, so let's go all the way over to 242. The last paragraph in that section. She says, in this Talmudic text, one particular image is explored, the conceit of the cedar. Apparently benign, the image proves unstable. Cedars turn out to be easy to topple in a storm, while Achaia's reed bends but does not break. Metaphors and similes may encompass contradictions. Undeclared passions may break through pleasant surfaces. And here's the citation. Language does not provide a simple key to meaning. The question seems to be, who says the words and how are they inflected by passion? Okay. And one of the things that you certainly have to recognize, I'm sure that the world is clearly recognizing this, is that bodily communication has been curtailed by the COVID restrictions in such a way that when we communicate digitally, we don't communicate what we really want to express because we are restricted to a visual digital image. You can hear it in my voice, but you can't see the interaction that I have in my positioning, in my gestures, and because those are the things that communicate the passion of this word. And without those, without the storytelling properties of face-to-face communication, a great deal of the transmission of the meaning is lost, right? It's lost because we've reduced communication to digital imagery instead of to bodily interaction in face-to-face confrontation, right? So given that that's the case and we've experienced that, it seems to me even more important that when we read the text, we don't read it as black print on white pages, right? If I'm just reading the text, I'm not hearing what it says, and I'm not interacting with it in the way that it was intended. I need to feel the text. And to do that, I have to engage in it in a way so Balaam's curse becomes my words. God's response becomes a response to me. Balak's attestation becomes mine. Moses' hand becomes mine. I'm the one who's in front of the rock. I'm the one who hears God's pronouncement against Moses. I'm the one who has to cross the Jordan. I have to experience all of that, and I have to read it in such a way so that my feet get wet. My hand is hurt. My arm is sore. I have to have the bodily experience in order to make the text come alive in me in such a way that I can actually understand the communication that's built into it. Okay? And that means that I have to read the text as a psychoanalytic evaluation of myself. I have to read it as it penetrates into me. Right? Okay, so let's go over to 244. She's talking about a midrash from Rashi. She says, the background is, strangely, Balaam foresees the outset of that this will be his situation. He announces it to Balak. Most strangely, it is he who coins the expression, the word thing which God shall place in my mouth, which the midrash interprets so concretely. This condition of possession, of speaking in tongues, Sephorno implicitly also assigns to David, psalmist, poet, musician. He quotes 2 Samuel 23:2, the Spirit of God spoke through me. Okay. Now, why did I underline that? Because, you know, I constantly get comments from people about, well, what do we do about speaking in tongues in Corinthians when Paul talks about it? But speaking in tongues is part of the events of the Tanakh as well. It's just that we don't see it or appreciate it in the same way that it was appreciated in the time of David, right? For me to enter into a condition where God speaks through me is to prophesy. That doesn't mean that I'm predicting the future. It means that the Spirit of God uses me as a vehicle for speaking what's on God's heart. Okay? And that process is part of the revealing process that occurs, but interpreted through the language of the speaker. Right? It's not as though God's dictating the words through me. He's using his Spirit to announce his intention, his feeling, his appraisal of the circumstances in a way for the audience to respond, because the intention is to have a meaning for the audience in a way that allows me to be the, not just the medium, that's a Greek idea, but to be the active interpreter of the message as it moves through me, okay? And if I understand speaking in tongues that way, then I can understand why it happened to Saul, why it happens to David, why Paul talks about it, what happens in the prophets during the, you know, pre-exilic age. I can understand all that kind of stuff. Whenever it says, and the word of the Lord came to, I realize now I'm dealing with a common phenomenon. I'm not dealing with something exceptional or something odd or strange. Okay. That it's part of this experience, this psychological movement of being attached to what it is that God's expressing feeling or thinking. Okay? So let's go a little bit further. On the bottom of 246, she's still talking about Balak and Balaam, and she says in the last paragraph, in the thinking of the British psychoanalyst Melanie Klein, envy is a primary and universal emotion which interferes tragically with the infant's first emotional relationship with the mother. For her, envy and gratitude are two sides of the same coin, one diminishing life, the other enhancing it. Unlike jealousy, envy represents a malign resentment of the good object. It stems from within, is insatiable, and always finds an object to focus on. It is purely destructive, not least of the infant's own mental development, which requires the building up of a good object. Okay? And then she said at the top of 247, in the Midrashic view of Balaam, such an understanding of envy is implicit in the emphasis on his evil eye. Okay, so the important part about what Zornberg says here is the distinction between jealousy and envy. Right? And now you can understand why God says that he's jealous, but he never says that he's envious. Right? Because envy represents this completely destructive process, not jealousy. Jealousy has a legitimate purpose for God. Envy does not. So, bottom of 247, she says, I suggest that, as in the case of Job, if we imagine Moses writing the story of Balaam, Moses' inner life becomes palpable to us for an instant as a mystery that can be intimated only through the indirections of the work of his own writing. If Job is a kind of alter ego, staging the forces that play in Moses' life, in Moses himself, then Balaam too serves in a way of working through crucial aspects of Moses' own life struggle. So she wants to read the character of Moses through Job and Balaam. Okay? And then that takes us to 248. Where she says, take for instance Moses' early struggle with his own mouth, his tongue, his lips, and then halfway down the middle of that page, the implication of this reading, she's talking about another midrash. The implication of this reading is that such impediments of mouth and tongue represent inner preoccupations whose tension can find relief only if trust loosens the vocal cords. God is angry with Moses for refusing to allow himself to come to birth in language. Moses' struggle with language thus can be understood as a reluctance to be born into the world of others. Okay? And for this, I am reminded once more of Moshe Chaim Luzzatto's great book, Mesilat Yesharim, where he points out that self-awareness is an infinite debt. Because it occurs only in relation to others. So it's interesting that if I read Moses' resistance to God's command that he go to rescue the people by claiming that he doesn't speak the language, you know, he stutters, et cetera, that refusal to accept language is a refusal to allow God to push him into a world where he will be relationally connected to other people. And that seems to me really important because Moses comes from 40 years in the desert. He's been alone for 40 years, or at best with a very small number of family members, right? He has isolated himself from the larger world of relationship, right? For fear. Maybe he had good reason, but the point is God is pushing him to reconnect through language with the larger community. And that's what Moses resists. He doesn't resist going out to be in command of leading the people out of Egypt. That was his original goal to begin with. That, you know, 40 years earlier, that's what he thought he was going to do. What he resists is relationship. Right? What he resists is the attempt, is God's pushing him to be relationally connected with the assembly And we see this same pattern of behavior, not just in Genesis, in Exodus chapter 3, but all the way through the account in Numbers. When Moses makes one attempt after another to overcome this relational disparity, only to retreat into a position where he stands apart from everyone. Okay? And ultimately, that's what defeats him. Okay, so she says on 249, she's talking about Zipporah's, you know, in Exodus 4:26, this really strange passage where it says God seeks to kill him because he didn't circumcise his son, right? So in the paragraph following that, she says, strangely, she's talking about the words, in your blood you shall live, from Ezekiel 16:6. Mit Boseret, wallowing, suggests defeat, degradation, soiling, kicking about, and life. Strangely, these words are recited at the circumcision of a male infant with Chaya, you shall live, in the feminine form, unselfconsciously quoted in this most masculine procedure. The passage from Ezekiel, which tells of the purely female experience of the birth of a female infant, is uncannily absorbed into male symbolism of circumcision. In spite of the repellent blood, God decrees that the infant shall live, or at the cost of your blood, live. The phrase is repeated in allusion to the two bloods of circumcision and the paschal sacrifice. Self-sacrifice ensures life. Right? That's a worthy little bit of citation. So let's go over to 250, where she concludes this idea. In the first full paragraph, to be born or reborn requires desire. The ambiguities of desire represent for Moses a dilemma that accompanies him through his whole life. The issues of circumcision, of blood, of connection and separation play a significant role in his life. And what she's really said is, when he comes to the end and he has not circumcised his son, that ambiguity, his refusal to actually take on one of the primary tribal identifiers, shows that he himself is vacillating on whether or not he wants to maintain this relational connection. Okay? So she says, there is, for example, the following Midrashic story about the blood of circumcision. Pharaoh angrily rejects Moses' demands, God be with you, the same as I mean to let your children go and go with you. See, evil is facing you, from Exodus 10:10. Rashi comments, understand this as the Targum takes it. See, the evil you are about to do will turn against yourself. Right? I have heard a Midrashic explanation. There is a certain star, the name of which is Ra, evil. Pharaoh said to them, by my astrological art, I see the stars rising toward you in the wilderness. It's an emblem of blood and slaughter. But Israel sees it consequently exactly the opposite. It affects Pharaoh because it's the evil facing him. Okay, so on 251, at the last of this section, she says, Moses plays a central role in this Midrashic narrative. It is his protest about the Egyptian narrative of doom, about the future as written in the stars, that moves God to turn the blood. For Moses, this moment of turning, which reconfigures the narrative, is of intimate concern. He writes Balaam's story because of it. For turning implies that a determined future may become an opened future. Okay? You see how important that sentence is? For turning, the ability for the use of the Hebrew word shuv, which is to return, means that a fixed future is now going to be rewritten in an open future, right? That what seemed to be the case is now going to be changed into what might be the case. So you can appreciate Heschel's comment, no word of God's is God's last word, final word, because the future always depends on the interweaving of present relationships, and those depend on the actions that we take and the actions that God takes. So here, the determined future doesn't occur because every time that there's a turning, a new future opens. Okay? One of the great tragedies of Christian theology is Thomas Aquinas' view of a timeless God, because all that does is prevent human beings from actually believing that they have an impact on what God does in the world, right? Hebrew doesn't embrace that idea. That's a Greek idea. And Zornberg is pointing out exactly that Hebrew opposition to a fixed future by saying that in this notion of turning, we assume that things can be different, okay? So let's go over to 252, this section on circumcision becoming whole. And she says, in the middle of 253, the middle paragraph there in the page, God has just told him, walk before me and become whole. This is from Genesis 17:3. Abram fell on his face, and God told him, walk before me and come whole. God then speaks of the Brit, the covenant between Abraham and himself, focusing on the commandment of circumcision. Rashi reads, he fell down out of awe of God's presence. Till he circumcised himself, he had no strength to stand upright before the Holy Spirit. That is what is written by Balaam, falling with open eyes. Right? Rashi's source, Pirkei Derab, to Rabbi Eliezer, focuses on the power of circumcision. And she says at the end of that paragraph, the Hebrew word arel, uncircumcised, is a positive adjective describing a natural but unevolved state. These paradoxes are reflected in Midrashic literature. And then she has a long description of how that works. And we're going to go over to 254, where she says, about four lines down from the top of the page, what precipitates the collapse is the moment of the commandment. A new ideal of wholeness puts the past stability of his life into question. He now exists in a new narrative. Right? What's the new narrative? The narrative of the language of circumcision, right? In which circumcision constitutes a challenge to accustomed meanings. Self-consciousness changes his body sense. He now understands that his habitual condition is less masterful than he had imagined. It is circumcision that gives one the strength to confront God. The paradox of becoming whole by cutting off a part of oneself does not escape Midrashic notice, right? In other words, it's just a symbolic representation of becoming whole through self, literally, self bodily part sacrifice, right? And then she summarizes this on 255, which is where we'll stop. She says, she's talking about the psychoanalytic structure of the story, and she goes back to jouissance, the French idea of joy, right? She says, Eigen describes the act of circumcision, as in Abraham's case, as an act that modulates one's tyrannical servile sides. It brings Abraham closer to God, opens him to free-flowing jouissance, the bliss of aliveness. Surrendering the illusion of mastery, one is released to one's true self, right? And she says, then she quotes Ezekiel, how is this transformation to be achieved? Quote, and God your God will circumcise your heart and the hearts of your offspring to love God your God with all your heart and your soul in order that you may live, Deuteronomy 36. The effect of circumcision is the ability to love God for the sake of life. Such circumcision of the heart is an act of covenant, creating connection between oneself and the other, who is God. And then she summarizes this at the end of the next paragraph. She's talking about Balaam. Clinging to his fantasy of knowledge and control, his immediate desires for honor, wealth, and destruction of the other block him from the unlimited jouissance of surrender. And of course, what Zornberg is pointing out is circumcision is essentially an act of surrender, which paradoxically enhances one's ability to live. not diminishes it. Okay. So we'll stop there. And we'll pick up next time on page 258, where she talks about Moses justifying his ways. Okay, so the plan, of course, is that we'll meet next Shabbat and Sunday for the lectures, and then we'll plan on continuing until we get to the end of the book, which we're coming very close to, and then we'll have a couple of open sessions, I hope, to catch up on all the things that I skipped over that you found so interesting in the text. But now, if you have any questions about what we've, you know, covered it today, or something that was left over from yesterday, feel free. Open up your microphone and let me know.
Hey, Skip, this is Mike. Was making the comment about how imagination is really, you know, a God-given gift, and how it is key to understanding the scripture. You know, it's our interpretation, our imagination that allows that.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, that imagination is God's gift, because I would assume that God also has imagination, that he can imagine things, right? And because he has the capacity to make his imagining become real, he has a different approach to imagination, but it doesn't make it any less important for us. Imagination is, in some respects, a deeply spiritual connection to the heart of God, right? Imagination is a way that we create the way that God does, right? God speaks things into existence. We can imagine things into existence. It doesn't mean that they become real, but they're real in the imagination, and that's as close as we're going to get to the kind of experience of creativity, of creative energy that God has, right? So I think you're really, really good point. It's not simply that we have to imagine the world of the text so that we can enter into it. It's that we have to also imagine our own lives so that they can become what God intends them to be, right?
Yeah, and interestingly too, you know, you look at a child's imagination, you know, how wondrous they are, and yeah, how that is somehow lost as we get into adulthood.
Yeah, we've learned to restrict ourselves to the black and white text.
Yeah.
Right? And the black and white life. What's right and what's not right. What's right and what's wrong, what's good, what's evil, instead of this, as you said, this childlike idea of imagining what the world could be. Maybe we need to rethink Yeshua's comment about as a small child, right, where he brings the little children. Maybe it had nothing to do with innocence. Maybe it had to do with imaginative power.
Yeah. He even says you must become as little children.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Anybody else?
Yeah, the whole notion of language and creativity just opens up a whole new vista. I mean, I think we all have read cursing and blessing is in the lips of your mouth or in your language, but the whole notion of it being connected to creativity, to be pro-creators with God, is just mind-blowing.
I'm so happy
that I dream in color.
I think let me give you an example, a real case story of an example of how language forms our own lives. Okay, you all know the story of the 14-year-old that I tried to help get out of the homeless shelters in South Africa, Irene, right? One of the things that I learned, sadly, was that she was not capable of seeing herself in any other world because she didn't have the vocabulary that belonged to any other world. The only language structure she had was the language structure of the homeless community. And that language structure was dependency, completely temporally oriented. Only what happens today matters. I seek pleasure wherever I can get it, and there's no idea of postponing gratification and to achieve something more. Her world, her language formed the world that she lived in, and because she wasn't able to speak any other language, she couldn't think herself outside of the box, right? It reminds me of Wittgenstein. He created the philosophical idea of language games. And basically what he says is a language game is a set of rules that tell you how the game is played inside the language, right? If you want to explode that and become something else, you have to change the game. It doesn't do you any good to get better at speaking the language that you already have. You have to start speaking a different kind of language so that your world is reshaped according to this new language game. And I'm certain that all of you have experienced that when you've encountered someone who, as Zornberg says, believes that they're absolutely righteously right, and their language is restricted to the box that they're in, and they can't think of the meaning of the words any differently, and subsequently, they're not able to even see a different way of reading the text, right? It's not that it's their fault. The language prescribes exactly how the text must be read. And if I don't change the vocabulary, I can't change the thinking of the text. And we've all encountered that. The unfortunate thing is we encounter it not just with the people that we're trying to show them, you know, what we've discovered in this Hebraic worldview. We encounter it in every single aspect of our lives. In our relationships to marriage partners, in our relationships to children, in the way that we handle work. Our language determines that kind of behavioral process. It determines the scope of it limits the scope of our imaginative process of how the relationship could function if we were able to step outside of the language that we've adopted. Right?
Mm, yeah.
One of the things we had said when we started the Hebraic journey was that we needed to change our language, that we needed to use new words that had the new meanings to sort of encourage people to ask questions, you know, instead of staying in the old paradigms and never being able to make that, you know, connection. We said, so from now on, we're going to start using the proper terms or the proper words just to try and open up, you know, more of the discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Curiosity, right?
Yeah, it's exactly like moving from Jesus to Yeshua.
Exactly.
It creates questions, right?
Right.
People start asking you, why are you doing that? And then that opens the door, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it takes a conscious effort, especially if you've been doing it for several years, right?
Hey, it's what I've been doing every day for 17 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's why there's 7,000 word studies, or almost 8,000 now, right? 8,000 attempts to say, okay, what if it means this?
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Skip, it's Brenda. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Brenda, go ahead.
Well, David, I think you had more to say. Okay. I was just going to say, some years ago, I felt I wanted to understand Hebrew. And so I started to look at it, and it was actually Paleo Hebrew. And at the time, I was struck with the thought that how would people communicate looking at pictures? Yeah. And then as time went on, I realized that they interpreted that picture through their own lens. And then I thought, well, that's really amazing. And then as it progressed and I realized that Hebrew was basically consonants and then with the vowels put in, I thought, oh my gosh, that's carried on from Paleo Hebrew in that you can look at text and put in your own verbs to read it, to see it how another way. And it's just kind of evolved that way I so appreciate this book and your study on this book because we're finding that after our after this time, we sit and we go over, and then when we read the text again, we're getting downloads of emotion, tremendous emotion that brings tears at times, and just it's kind of like God is opening a door here to a deeper understanding of who we are and how we can interact with Him, but not only Him, but how it's helping us in the world at this present time.
Yeah.
So we thank you very much.
Oh, well, you're welcome. It's I hope that it's not me. It's just Zornberg. You know, Zornberg's the one who's writing
this. Yes.
He's
but
really, really good at this. But we, but I think we need to add one thing, and that is, even though it's possible for me to add whatever vowels I want and read the text in however individually I think, I'm also a part of a corporate identity. So the checks and balances are, I sit down with my rabbi friend, and I can say, yeah, but Rabbi Zev, I can read it like this. And then he will say, yeah, but in our tradition, da-da-da-da-da, right? So we have that checks and balance going all the time, which allows the imaginative process to occur, because I will say to him, well, wait a minute, why is it like this? And then he'll say, oh, I never thought of that. That's a great idea. We should look. And then he will say, don't you see it's written like this because of this? And then I will say, oh, my gosh, that's right. I never saw that, right? So that checks and balances process goes on all the time. So it's not just I don't come to the text as, oh, you know, I don't come to the text like a Greek, right? Man is the measure of all things. No, sorry. Community is the measure. And so as I interact with others in the text, the relationship brings more understanding, but it's always subject to the imaginative process that goes on. So whether I belong to a Jewish tradition or Messianic community or even in a Christian tradition, as long as I have the imaginative process as part of my interaction with God's word, more and more downloads will occur, right? That's the best part.
Yeah. That's the best part. Thank you.
Yeah. Larry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I was just going to say there's pros and cons to the virtual meetings. I mean, without this virtual meeting, we wouldn't have the community that we have here today. The downside is I don't get to say things to Dan like I know he's gone through the loss of his two parents. I think Zornberg said that remembering is infinite. And so what I would ask Dan to do is if he wants to do it today or another time, tell us something about either your mother or father or both that you'll remember, that when you think about them, comes to mind, if you will.
Yeah, that's good. We'll have, fortunately, I will see Dan in person in August in Texas. I'm looking forward very much to that. And that you're right. The pro is that we get to at least see each other, even if it's digital, but it would be so nice to have a family reunion and bring everybody from all over the world into a place where we could actually interact with each other. Yeah.
Thank you for remembering me.
Yeah. You're not forgotten, my friend. Anybody else want to make a comment today before we close? Okay. Well, then I guess I will see you next Saturday. And we'll push forward and go a little bit deeper into this psychoanalytic evaluation of Moses and of ourselves in the process. All right? So, ciao. Arrivederci. I'll see you next week. Okay. Bye. Bye.